So thank everyone for coming in this morning and all of that. So we are talking about innovation, and you are each here for a very specific reason. And why don't we go around the table and just introduce ourselves? And David, why don't we start with you?
Sure. My name is David Amster Olszewski from SunShare.
And what is SunShare?
We're a solar energy company. We were the first company to start developing community solar gardens in the United States. So anyone in a utility service territory can use solar energy without the panels on the roof.
Nina.
My name is Nina Pollack. I'm the program executive for the Bachelor of Innovation at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs.
And how new is that program?
Program had first intake of students in fall 2007, so we've had two graduating classes so far.
Excellent. And Eddie?
I'm Eddie Stillman. My wife and I own Stillman Industries. It's an innovation company. And our purpose is to make the world better, solve the problems. And we do have problems, but we also have solutions.
Great. The first thing that is sort of a probably not going to be a surprise question for any of you, but how do you define innovation? Innovation to me is sort of this abstract term. How would you define it? Nina.
Well, we had to look into this in creating a Bachelor of Innovation. That's one of the first things that comes up is what do you mean by innovation? So at the beginning, we looked at lots and lots of definitions, and there are many. And we settled on one that's pretty broad, but seems to capture it, especially for our students. And we define innovation as the transformation of ideas into impact. So that's a process definition. Lots of things have to happen, from generating the ideas to making them real and having the impact.
Great. Eddie?
It's a very good definition, Nina. The way I look at it, innovation is a process. Most people confuse inventions with innovation. Invention is just one step, one event in the beginning of the innovation process. But it's a long process from an idea to having a product. So I think it's a great thing for us. It's been great. So we named our street Innovation Way because that's what the world needs.
David?
I'd say innovation is thinking outside of the box and then having the persistence to bring the ideas that you found outside of the box into the reality that we all live in and making those changes happen.
Go ahead, Nina.
Sounds like there's a lot of agreement as to the definition, which is great.
Eddie, you mentioned that innovation really is a process, and that it's people confuse it with invention. And so, do you then think that the word innovation is applied not enough? I mean, do you think that there's other ways that it should be applied?
No, I think people generally know. And it doesn't really matter. The message is that I think thinking outside the box and doing something with it, as David explained, I think it's great. I think that's what it's all about. So the definition itself doesn't concern me. And there are aspects that do concern me, which we can get into.
Go ahead.
Well, the process itself, that's very, very tough, because if you're outside the box, it's against the flow of traffic. You're really fighting our culture. As we grow up, we're taught you cannot be different. You cannot be outside the box. And to get outside the box, you create enemies right off the bat, because you disturb the comfort zone of the existing environment. So you have to be tenacious. David, you were right. You have to really be tenacious and never give up, because people are afraid of change, especially if they make money. If you're trying to replace, let's say, oil with something that is sun energy, there are lots of people that are making money and they don't want you to do it. So, but if you believe in it and you do it, it's tremendous satisfaction. I love it. I just love it. But I expected it not to be easy. But we do need to change our culture. We've got to embrace changes because the world changes all the time. The only constant on this planet is change. Things are going to change. Are you going to embrace it or you're not going to survive? Right now we're at the point where it's not that it'd be nice to innovate more convenient thing. We have to solve our problem or we're not going to survive. So that's where innovation has to happen and people have to support it, not fight it.
Nina or David?
I absolutely agree. One of the challenges we have when we're trying to teach students about innovation and the innovation process is this whole idea of, okay, you can have all the creative ideas in the world, but if you do nothing with them, they actually didn't matter. So yes, creativity is important, thinking outside the box is important, but it's not like there's a paucity of ideas. Ideas are everywhere. It's grabbing onto the idea that makes sense and actually putting it into some kind of implementation, some kind of action that makes a difference. That means you're talking about change processes all the time. How do cultures change? How do organizations change? How do nations change? And that becomes a part of innovation. I think people don't think about at first. They think about the invention or the creativity. And it's great to say, yes, we want to have an impact. But all of the stuff that happens in between that Eddie was just pointing out on how do you get people persuaded to try a new way? How do you bring people to a different point of view? All of that turns out to be, I think, one of the biggest challenges of innovation.
David?
Something that Eddie said really struck me. He spoke about tenacity. And as a young entrepreneur, I find myself, and I think the most recent time was yesterday, someone said I was referred to as tenacious, and I knew the person who was talking about me, and it wasn't meant as a compliment.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that's one of the interesting things that entrepreneurs are innovators or change agents, whatever you want to call them, have to face and deal with is this concept of we all appreciate change. Everybody, if you ask them if change is good, they'll say yes, most likely. But when faced with it truly themselves, changing some way or something, how they do things, it's a different story. And finding out how to make people comfortable with change, I think it's really a comfort issue. If people are comfortable with change, innovation will flow. And how do you create that in organizations, in countries, in schools, this comfort around thinking differently, that it's okay to do so.
Mm-hmm. Eddie.
I really appreciate what you're saying. I was lucky. I was born in Israel, and you had to innovate to survive. We had nothing. I was born before Israel. It was called Palestine. And when I was 7 years old, Israel became a state. And the same evening, fighting started. Israel had no army, no way of defending itself, so innovation was a necessity. And that's the mother of invention, it's necessity. When you have to have something, you're going to come up with solutions. And because I was born with this culture, I question everything. Why are we wasting water? And why are we wasting electricity? And there are so many things that we're doing because we never face having to do without it. So, but that's not how our kids grow up. Nina and I talked just before, and people asked me to talk about innovation. And my grandson was in the first grade, and I was invited to talk about innovation. And the first thing I did with the kids, I asked them, how many of you are inventors? Wow, everybody raised their hand. I invented this, I invented that. First grade. I was so happy, it was great. But I did tell them, stay that way. Don't let anybody tell you you're not. Made a big point out of it. It's great. So proud of you, stay that way. They invited me again when they were second grade. And I asked the same question. So I'll ask you, Nina, you cannot say it. But David, how many do you think, how many kids do you think were still inventors? Raise their hand.
I'd say the number probably reduced to half.
Only, well, you got it, but it was worse than that. Only three kids raised their hands saying, I'm an inventor. And it was awful for me. It was crushing because I thought I inspired them. So something happens to us as we grow up. Before, and we don't even know it, saying, no, 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 you cannot be different. Why do you always have to be different? And they force you to conform. And that's how we lose innovators. Hearing about it in college or universities, it's way too late.
Yes.
We've got to just keep doing it. But it's not just in school that we have to conform to get grades. And if you don't get a C, if you get a D, something is wrong with you. Just support our children in being themselves. It's okay to be different. It's okay to question. And it's culturally. So I think you're doing great. You're the rare example of going the right direction. But most people are afraid to be different.
Yeah,
they don't want to be different.
We certainly see that when kids come into college. A lot of them are there because they want the degree to get the good job. And so if you start talking about innovation, the first thing they want to know is what's going to be on the test and how do I make sure that I succeed in the class. So breaking through that sort of thinking to say, oh, no, we're studying now an innovation process, we're studying entrepreneurship. It really does require you to think differently. When we do have exams, the exams do not look like traditional college exams, which throws students off sometimes, but they come around and go, wow, that actually made me think, which was the whole purpose of it. But there's a lot to overcome. I did looked at some research on creativity. Not so much innovation, but the first part of innovation, the creativity, and it declines. It's greatest in children. It declines through high school. It declines through college. It declines through graduate school. I mean, so, you know, people with PhDs are in bad shape for creativity if they don't do something active about that and learn the techniques, learn how to question again, learn how to look at things differently again. So it's a big challenge, and it'd be much less of one if we figured out how to keep it open and creative and where difference is valued throughout the K through 12 years.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, Nina, that talking about innovation, you take an idea that makes sense and then you go out and you do it. Let's talk a little bit about what the measure is of what when an idea catches on and how you know it's the right thing to move forward with. David?
A lot of things lead into an answer to that question, and sometimes I'm not really sure what's allowed me to be successful other than just being in the right place at the right time and all of it being chance. However, I think something that's been going around the table already, which is being open to new ideas, plays a critical role in making that happen. I was asked to speak to a class at Colorado College a week ago, and it was an entrepreneurship class. And I had actually taken that class 4 or 5 years ago when I was a student. And I took them out to one of our solar farms. And then yesterday, I was invited back to sit on a panel of people advising the class when they were doing their business plan pitches. And I was just shocked by the creativity that people, these students, brought to the table. And this wasn't like any normal class. Students were told class was optional. They didn't have to show up. There was no final exam. And, oh, by the way, you're leaving the class with an F. And if by the end of the year you haven't started your business, that F will stay. And if you have started a business or done something with it, you'll get an A. But other than that, there's no rules. And there's no rules for success on how you determine success of your business either, whether or not you've sold something. That's all left up to chance. But the approach was very different from when I first took the class, and it forced creativity, because if there was no creativity, the answer was an F. But there were no structure around how you were to do that. And that lack of structure forced the need, like Eddie was talking about, to invent something and then to follow through with it. Now, the pitches were great, but they're only 3 weeks into it. So you'll have to see later down the year what actually comes of it. But that's the persistence piece, perseverance, and having the tenacity to follow through with that concept that they originally had. And seeing that at the college level and seeing the enthusiasm and excitement that came from that was amazing. It makes me wonder, can that be done at different levels of education? Does that have to only be something that you do at a liberal arts college? Could you do it at a state college? Do you do it? Probably.
Oh, absolutely.
Can you do it in a kindergarten class? Can that be done every year of your education through 20?
Yeah, the Daniels Fund in Denver actually does it for grade school, middle school, high school students. And they pitch an idea, they're given a mentor, and they actually start the business. So it's happening around. What I'm struck by when you ask the question of how do you know it's the right idea, first thing it brought to mind was when we look at innovation, you can innovate in many different ways. Okay, so you can be inside a large organization and still innovate. Entrepreneurship is a huge means toward making your innovation or your idea real. So a lot of people take that path. They become entrepreneurs, as Eddie has and David has, in order to take their idea into the world. But the way you know if it's the right idea is you get out there and you start trying it. You talk to people about it. You build the prototype. You do the research. You figure out what's the next step, and you keep taking steps and learning from what the environment tells you so that you can take the next step and the next step and the next step. So I don't think there's a big magic to it, like there's some point in time where it says, that's the perfect idea, run with that one. I think it really is a learning process as well.
Mm-hmm. Eddie?
We define sense. People keep asking, does it make sense? It doesn't make sense. But I've never seen a definition of what it is. So we defined it for innovation. So when somebody comes up with an idea to me, or when I come up with an idea, we measure it. So we define sense with acronyms to the word sense. S-E-N-S-E. And the first letter is for simple. If you cannot explain your idea to a six-year-old, it's not a simple idea. That's the most important thing. People come up with some things, but they're too complicated. It's never going to be successful. So first thing, if you really simplify it, and it's amazing, they can. Usually if they go back, think about it, they find a simpler way. The second one is E, the second letter, which for efficient. Everything has to be efficient. Your time has to be efficiently spent, your money, everything. So if you come up with an idea that you want it to mature to a product, measuring the efficiency is very important. But the next letter is the heart. It's the most important one. And for needed. A lot of people having great ideas that nobody needs. So, but in innovation, defining that there is a need is the most important thing. Because if you look like David in what you've done, there is a need. If there was not a need, a farm would never go anyplace. But that's the first question. But that's what happens to me is when I find a situation that doesn't make sense to me is there is a need for something to happen. And can I solve it with my experience, the tools that I learned? Can we stop global warming? First thing is there a problem? And if you say, yes, there is a real problem, then it's worth trying to go through the other letters because it has to be all the things that I'm describing. So the next letter is safe. It has to be safe. There are lots of solutions that solve one problem, but they create other problems. And safety in industry is sometimes never thought of till people start dying because of what you came up with. So safety cannot be ignored. And the bottom line in this society is it has to be economical. If it's not economical, if people will not spend their money to buy it, don't start with it. You're wasting your time. So, but if you meet all these criteria, then the idea makes sense.
Nina?
I would just add that it's sometimes difficult to determine if there's a need, because going out and asking people if there's a need doesn't always get you that answer. We don't know what we don't know. We don't know what would be useful. So some of the really big innovations that have changed our lives recently, such as smartphones, if you'd asked me in the 90s if I needed that, I would probably have said, no, I don't need that. You know, I'm fine doing what I'm doing. But then it appears, and it's like, oh, okay, I see how I can make myself more productive or have more fun or stay in touch better or whatever I determine those needs to be. But you can't determine it by asking someone. So then you have to do like Eddie says. Now you're looking for what are the problems and how could I solve them, as opposed to, say, doing a focus group and asking people what they need. So it's not a simple process, I think, to determine needs. It requires astute observation and figuring out what the problems are and how you can make a solution fit.
David.
You know, something I'd build on with what you were saying, Nina, sometimes a lot of it is listening. A lot of people ask me, did you come up with the idea of community solar gardens? You were the first company in the country that did this. And actually the answer is no, I didn't. And it took my mother telling me this idea for several months before I actually took it on. She said, well, we can't get solar in our house because we have trees covering it. So, but I still want to get solar panels, so how can I do that? Now, I was a little hard-headed. I should have taken it after the first time I heard it, but after I heard it three times from her and then I started talking about it with other people, you started to see that there's a need. But the actual idea didn't come from the entrepreneur. It came from the environment around the entrepreneur. And I think one of the other things, I don't know if we're going to start touching on, but is the community of innovation. And how do you, I'm sure that's something that you do, Nina, at UCCS, is how do you build a community of innovation where entrepreneurs, creative people work together, have support systems, like you were talking about a mentorship program that helps facilitate this process. Because you can have an idea, but you need mentors to help you take that idea to the next level, to bring in experience from different areas, to actually make that idea, that impetus successful.
Right. What we say, the tagline, I guess, that we use is that innovation is a team sport. You might have the person who had the insight or the person that sees the problem, but they have to gather around them people to help them actually implement the idea. It's almost never done by yourself if you're going to have a big impact. So in our program, we attempt to build a culture of innovation for these students that are pursuing this degree so that is acceptable. It's the way of thinking. It's a normal way of thinking by the time they graduate. That's our hope. But yeah, absolutely required that you get help from other people.
I think part of it is being an example. People, kids, don't see an example of success in innovation. They see it in sports. But so that's why we set up our place, to be an example of successful innovation and inspire young minds to think, wow, I really love to be an engineer or a technician. And that's what we're trying to do. So we love to have people, especially if they're young, still open-minded, come to see what we do. That's our main purpose, is to inspire young people to be innovators. Nina, you were talking about how things deteriorate with the educational level. It's absolutely true, but it goes further than that. What we find that it continues, and the longer they work in traditional places, the less innovative or creative they become. We got to a point where we decided we'll never hire anybody with experience. if they've got all this years of experience and they haven't created anything, it becomes negative. The team, one person that is negative will destroy any project. So I'd rather not have somebody with a lot of experience of doing something the wrong way. Rather get somebody that doesn't have any experience, get into our culture that has a lot of supports, and it's special culture to promote innovation. So we had people like Vice President of General Motors, and we thought, wow, we got the best guy. It was terrible, because what applies in a big company is just continue doing what you've been doing. And we're doing the opposite. We're doing things that nobody has ever done. Most people think it's impossible. And as far as asking people about is something needed or not, I skip this step because I know what you said is true. If they don't have it, then they're going to be negative about it. So I trust myself, my instincts. If it makes sense to me, I do it. But that gets into another real key element, is self-confidence. If somebody has self-confidence, maybe grew up in a supportive environment, that they still are creative. But if somebody does not have self-confidence, then you can never change. So one of the questions was, can you make inventors? Or is it too late? Either they are inventors or not. Really depends on their personality. Some people were invested a lot in thinking, oh, they're so smart, they'll get it. But if they don't believe in themselves, you really have to have people that they believe that they can be right and the rest of the world can be wrong, and not worry about the rest of the world. If the rest of the world would have solved the problem, you wouldn't even be thinking about it. But so self-confidence is big part that's very, very hard to change.
You know, I want to go back to something that you were talking about, and I think something that you said, Nina, and you said, Eddie, can go almost hand in hand on the same topic, which is you don't know that we need it until we need it, which is how something like the iPhone comes around and basically shifts culture. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's something like global warming, which is if you believe in global warming, if you believe in climate change, there's a non-immediacy sort of association with that. So I'm wondering how you are able to determine need or think about need or making sense in terms of how do you know that you're going to give somebody something they didn't know they needed, or how do you show them they need something that they're not necessarily thinking about.
Do you want me to take it? And I hate to talk all the time, so cut me anytime. But there's one example that was very, very clear in my life that there was a need. Some things are very clear, and some things are more nebulous, like global warming, that people can argue about. But what happened, I was visiting Israel after I was in the space program, and I invented the valve for the Apollo project. But when I was in Israel, they had a problem with irrigating the fields near the border. Syria had the Golan Heights and they had snipers. And when the Israelis were turning on the irrigation valves, the Syrians would shoot them. So when I was there, two Israeli soldiers, they had to irrigate with the army. The army had tanks and the soldiers would jump and the tank would provide the shield, but the snipers were pretty smart and they knew how to kill them. So two young Israeli soldiers were killed. And I couldn't sleep that night because I thought there's got to be a solution. And I invented wireless irrigation system that had no wires to begin with, that you can bury the controller under the ground, and with a 9-volt battery, it would irrigate an entire field for a year without changing the battery. So you didn't have to have this issue. So the best way to solve a problem is to eliminate it. And if people having to come to irrigate fields when somebody's shooting at them is the problem, how about if they didn't have to do it, if something else did it for them? So that was a very clear cut of, hey, there was a need. When people are dying, trying to irrigate. Go ahead,
Nina. I think you are a great example of looking at innovation in both ways. And the ways I think of it are, one, there's something wrong here. There's a problem. It needs to be fixed. So I'm going to go after fixing it. But the other way is, there's something possible here. There's something better. It's not a big problem. Nobody's suffering. But I see a way it can be better. And I see in your career that you do both of those. Problem needs to be solved, as you just described. But also in some of your technology, possibility that can be worked on and created. And so you go both ways. And I think when you talk about ideas and how do you know what the need is, I think you can look at it both ways. And sometimes the innovations stem from the generative, I'm going to create something new, even though I don't see a particular problem for it, I see an opportunity there, versus there is a problem, I want to solve the problem. So both of those come into play.
It's a very good point.
David?
Something that I've thought a lot about is just the gut feeling. Do you have a gut feeling that something's right, that it's something that people will want? Is it something that you want to do? Being impulsive and being okay with being impulsive and embracing that. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of inventions that are out there are just somebody impulsively thinking about something and saying, I want that, I want to do that, I want to create that. And, you know, if you're talking about an iPhone or an iPad, well, I'd like to read my newspaper on something that I didn't have to throw away, and I'd like it to be available immediately. And you know what? Maybe I'd like to be able to read the New York Times and the Economist in the same night without having to pick up separate ones at separate stores, but I'd like to download them. Well, you never would have thought about that, or a lot of people wouldn't have thought about that, but somebody did. Somebody came up with it and made it happen. So what is that? How do you embrace that type of thinking? And I think there's some places where that's been done, Silicon Valley, Boulder, here in Colorado, and there's other places where that hasn't happened. But how do you create this culture of innovation whereby those ideas are supported? I think I visited Israel several years ago, and I think the whole country has a culture of innovation
exactly.
and change. I mean, there's
exactly.
cities. Yeah. You know, the largest city, Tel Aviv, I think,
right.
is just this hub of innovation of young people with new ideas, and it's okay to fail because sometimes innovations fail; they don't always succeed, and it's embraced there. And how do we? I feel like this is a question people in different countries are thinking about. I've heard Russia's trying to create a Silicon Valley, but people are thinking about how do you create cultures that promote innovation.
I think you hit on one of the really key things that has to be part of the culture, which is what is your attitude toward failure? How do you deal with failure? In an organization, how do you deal with failure? Somebody tries something and it doesn't work. If that means you get a bad performance review, if that means, you know, you get fired because you wasted company resources on doing something that didn't work, if that happens, then you're going to kill any possibility of a culture of innovation. So I think this relationship to failure is important in the culture. It's important in our systems, the larger systems, the societal systems we deal with. It's important for individuals. How are you as an individual with regard to failure? It ends up being a crucial element if you're going to build a culture of innovation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I don't have failure in my vocabulary. There's no such thing. David, you're right. I was born in Tel Aviv, and the culture supports innovation. You have to. Existence depending on somebody coming up with something crazy. Just haven't thought about it for almost 50 years, but talking about what David, you described, when the war started, Israel had no weapons, and the Syrians came from the Golan Heights with tanks, all line of tanks, and they were going to cut Israel in half. Israel had no weapons. So somebody came up with the idea of painting a tank on cardboards that they put together, just painted the tank. And when the column of tanks came to this kibbutz, this community at that time, they had this picture, painting of a tank, and it slowed down the entire column. So somebody from the place threw a Molotov cocktail into the first tank that just stopped, Syrian tank, blew it up the entire column, turned around. And that's something like that. It's crazy, but when you have to come up with something, somebody did, and Israel survived just because of that. If not for that person coming up with, hey, let's try something. If it doesn't work, so
we're no worse off.
Right.
We wasted some paint.
Yeah, but you're right. The fear of failure in grades is terrible. I was in a school in Israel that had no grades at all, not just failure. It's interesting in David's example of you either get an A or an F. Even that is not necessary. Why do we need to grade things? If you grade somebody, all you're going to do, you're going to make somebody feel bad, and it's not going to try again. So what's really important is culture of encouragement. So in our company, there's no such thing as grades or failures. We're a totally flat organization, no titles. There's only one because the law requires somebody to be president, and that's my wife, but nobody else. I don't have a title because even titles ruin everything because it puts this, I'm better than you and I know more, so.
Well, it sounds like maybe I'm reading too much into what you're saying, but it sounds like our entire educational system, or maybe even the American culture, is set up to discourage innovation, and yet we lead in so many different ways. Where's that balance? Where do you see us going in the future with this kind of necessity almost?
So I think one of the reasons we lead is because while we may discourage innovation and this sense of failure and stuff, through our school system, we still have a country where it's very easy to start a business and explore an idea. So the entrepreneurial spirit, or the idea that I can go out and make something happen as an individual, that's still strong. So that means that we have individuals who survive our school system, as we all have, right? except maybe Eddie, who survived a different school system. But we all survive our school system, and if you survive it with the idea that, oh, I can still go make something happen, the system is such that you can go try it out. It's still very easy to start a business here. There are other countries where that's not true. There are other cultures where that's not true. And I think when that's not true, you really limit what people are able to experiment with and try. Mm-hmm. So what we're talking about here is, how do we get better from where we are? How do we improve from where we are? If you start looking at it comparatively with the world, we're still okay. But lots of folks are catching up. So if you look at it in any way competitively, you should be worried about how we continue to get better.
Mm-hmm. David?
Well, something interesting that you mentioned, Nina, is learning outside of the classroom and having opportunities outside of the classroom. I think there's a lot of opportunity, like Eddie says, to improve what's happening within the classroom. But there's also a lot of opportunity that's already occurring outside the classroom. When I think about how I got confidence to become innovative, it had nothing to do with my classes, and I hope my professors aren't listening to this. but it really, a lot of it, so much of it had to do with what was happening outside of the classrooms. And a lot of that had to do with integrating with my professors, but in a different light, in a different way, working outside of that classroom environment where all of a sudden there were no more restrictions and you could think freely. One of the things Colorado College has is you have classes in the morning, in the afternoons you have free. Well, that's your time to innovate. That's your time to think outside of the box. And how do you get those two things to work well together? Because sometimes you do need a lecture. You do need to learn the principles of science and of economics. But then how do you have the time and create the time and space to apply those principles and integrate that with your own creativity to come up with new ideas? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the balance that if we we started to get broad talking about it as a country, if that's a balance that we could find as a country, that's something that a lot of Asian countries haven't picked up on yet. They're still looking at, I studied in China and there was a lot of memorization. I remember kids walking back and forth on the fields at 5 a.m. reciting things in English for tests. It was all memorization, mm-hmm. from what I can recall. But this outside this classroom, this other element of thinking creatively, that's something that we do have in America and Israel and Western countries, and how do we emphasize that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of the ways that we've looked at doing that in the BI program is essentially project-based work. So we have a sequence of classes that all of the BI students take, Bachelor of Innovation students, regardless of what they major in. They're taking a project course three times, so sophomore, junior, senior year, where they're working on cross-discipline teams, cross-level, sophomore, junior, senior, in teams doing projects for companies, startups. I've talked to you about that. Startups or other companies in the community and now beyond the community. We have teams whose clients are on both coasts and, you know, elsewhere, and we're looking to do some international work as well. But what that does is that says, okay, now you have to do something real. You have to make something happen in the world. In this case, it's not necessarily your idea. You're working on someone else's idea to help them implement it. But you're learning those things that we can't teach any other way because we don't know what's going to come up. So the projects class is somewhat chaotic. Every project is different because every client is different. And the students never know what's going to come up between them and their client and them trying to implement the project deliverables. So in that way, we still allow them to be in a situation where if they fail, it hasn't messed anybody up completely, right? Because they're still in a college environment, and yet they get a lot of experience on how to actually implement something in the world that we're really looking for, because that's such a key piece of innovation.
I agree. It's great. I think, Nina, what you're doing, and David, what you're doing, it's just awesome. It's just great, because that's how we're going to be able to survive in innovation. I agree that the rest of the world is catching and passing us. But some of the reason why America is innovative is the history. They had pioneers. They had to have people that did things that didn't make sense. They sacrificed themselves. And so it's a young country that had to innovate, and some of it is in the blood, in the character of Americans, is, hey, we can do things. We can be the best.
You know, I want to shift a little bit. I know, Nina, you mentioned that need is both a problem to solve versus something that will make life better. I think it's an interesting thing to see when old technologies are used in a new way. And one of those, I think David might be a perfect example of that, because the sun, while not a technology, it's harnessing that power, using that power, is an old idea. And so I'm wondering how do those things come about? And can we not learn from, like, why does it take, you know, years to be able to harness something that was an old technology or utilize it in a way that wasn't used before? I mean, do we not learn from our past?
I don't see it as not learning from our past. I think we're learning ever more. If you look at the history of technology specifically, you find that it's always a build. We continue to build. We have science, which discovers the phenomena that we want to take advantage of in our technology, but we're always building on what came before. Electric cars were the first way we went about doing cars. I mean, the idea was steam-powered cars, electric cars. We didn't come to gasoline until a little later in that process, but we didn't have the technology that could compete with gasoline. Electric cars didn't compete with gasoline, so they didn't make it. Now it's time to relook at that, because we have advanced in our understanding of batteries and how electric cars could work. Okay, now, will they win out this time? I don't know. There's other alternatives also being looked at today that might actually be better than electric cars. So I don't think, though, that we ignore the past. I think technology builds on itself. I think engineers build on old technologies as well. And we learn new things all of the time. So,
mm-hmm. David?
Go ahead.
It's a very interesting question. Do we not learn from the past? And I guess there's two answers that I could think of to that question. And number one is, well, a lot of times I don't think we do. I think we're just starting to relearn again how to orient our houses to face the sun so that it heats up naturally during the winter months and we don't have to use natural gas or electricity to heat our homes. So I think there's a lot of things that, now that's been done for thousands of years all across the world using passive solar heating. So I do think that there are things that we are relearning. Now the flip side is, I think that new connections are always being made. And I could even think about invention and innovation. There's different types of innovation. Some is technological, creating new products. But another one is creating new uses for existing products, changing the way things that things are put together. I didn't invent the solar panel. That's been around. That's been in satellites for decades. However, it's always had to be connected to what you needed to use it for. Well, we already have an electrical grid. So why can't we put panels on one side of the city and have people using electricity on other sides of the city and getting credited for that? Well, it's just a different, using a structure that we have and connecting the dots in a different way, and it's a different type of innovation. I think a lot of people just think of innovation as creating new product. That's definitely one aspect of it, but how do we take old ideas and find new uses for them?
Mm-hmm. Eddie?
Well, I think part of it is it economical or not? Some ideas were great at one time, like electric cars originally. But to me, it doesn't make sense. You're right, there are better ways of doing it. And as far as some solution create more issues. People don't think far enough. We are way overly electrified in our society. There are health effects. There are lots of connections. And I'm really scared of electricity and magnetism because I read so many books that connected all the electricity, the electric fields, the cell phones, to cancer. People didn't know how to explain cancer. Oh, you have cancer, you're going to die, or we're going to cut you to pieces first. But there is a connection. But a lot of people in the industry making money, so I'm going back to the very beginning of what I was saying, you solve one problem. Electricity is very convenient. But there are lots of issues with all our wires overhead and what it does. I think the solution is do things right. Combustion is not controlled right. We only get 30% of the energy in the fuel to do work for us. Why not 90%? It's possible, but you got an industry that doesn't want to change. They like to sell you the same cars, and they have the flavor of the month solution. Hydrogen is the answer, electricity is the answer. All sorts of solutions that are not sustainable. But most of it, is it economical or not? Electrical panels were not economical to be able to compete against oil, against other ways of doing things that cost less. Now, the things that cost less, like oil, creates a lot of problems. Pollution. Nobody measures the effects of pollution, even carbon. People are arguing whether somebody that puts carbon in the air should be penalized for doing it in comparison to somebody that doesn't do that. So the economical factor, if you don't pass it, don't even get started. If your idea would cost more to somebody, then they wouldn't do it. Your advertising or your promotion material is great because you show that, hey, it's very economical. And that's very, very good step forward. But we need to look at the whole picture. We cannot just look at the product by itself. What does it do? What's the effect of what it does? So timing, supply and demand is everything. If you're supplying something without demand, nobody's going to buy it. But that doesn't mean that demand is not going to change and people are going to want it at a different time. So life goes by cycles.
I want to move a little bit to, I think it was the last question that I had in the list that I forwarded, which is, you know, are there dangers in innovation? And I think that along with this is something that we've been talking about, which is that there are entities that fight against even if they don't fight against certain innovations or technologies, it's resistance because of procedures otherwise. So, for example, David, when you were setting up the solar garden, you had to get permission from the city. You had to work with the utilities. You had to convince them that this was the right thing to do. And so how do you sort of reconcile some of these multiple forces that come in either for, against, or neutral, but non-convinced of your ideas, to get them to work. And at the same time, let's stick with that one for a minute here.
I think the first thing you do is you build up a core of people who support you and give you open and honest feedback, because people will always tell you that your ideas are crap. And that's just a given. So what you have to do is find those people who do support you and who keep you balanced when you're going through those things, that support system, that community of support for failure, that failure is okay, and if it doesn't fail, that's great too, because you succeeded. I think, you know, something that is on my mind a lot lately is the election. I haven't heard more people talk in this recent election about how things can't happen. It's unbelievable. I think it's the absolute opposite of what we're looking for in America, which is being open-minded. And I think that's a structural change just as much as we talk about education. We have to start thinking about what do we put on the airwaves? I mean, what's the negative impact that comes from talking about how bad every new idea is because it may fail?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nina?
So I'm going to agree here with Eddie that things need to be economical, but that has two sides to it. They need to also be valuable. So I will pay more for something if I perceive greater value to it. So there's, or I will pay less for something that gives me the same value. But I'm always considering the value. But what I think you're getting to with the risk and the reward and the who prevents innovations from taking hold and so forth speaks to size and rules or systems, government's role, or where they have a role, where they don't. If you look at markets that can stay free, where people are allowed to experiment, where they can go try different ways of solving a problem, then the ways that make sense, according to Eddie's acronym there, the ways that make sense will tend to win out. What happens, though, is we sometimes get organizations that get really large, that get actually partnered with government, which is also really large at this time, that creates them a way to stay in place and resist change a lot. So we need to look to that. That's a systemic issue, so we need to look at, are we keeping the playing field the same for people? Are we favoring certain organizations over others, and for what purpose, for what reason? And always have to take a look at that. Mm-hmm. But if you keep it free, free minds, the ability to think clearly and to think freely and to not be confined into a certain box, and if you keep it available so that you have free markets or the chance for entrepreneurs to go off and experiment with things and get their ideas into a marketplace where people can then decide, does this provide me more value for the same cost or less cost for the same value?
Eddie.
Well, there are two sides to what you were saying. I'm going to talk about value in a second, but not all ideas are good ideas. Some ideas that somebody thinks it's got the, well, it's just like children. Oh, my baby's prettier than yours. It's just, but reality can get distorted. And so I'm okay with somebody saying, I have a better idea than yours, and I'm okay. That's great. Wonderful. So our egos and personalities get involved in our own creations. So I'm not against people killing ideas that should be killed. But the other is in value. That's a huge point that you brought up. It took me a while to realize we don't measure things the right way. Mm. Needs to be divided. I divide value into two parts. One is tangible, things that you can measure the economic value, return on investment. When I come up with an idea, and I present it to a company, what's the return on investment? They only look at numbers. Numbers is only one part of it. But I believe that the intangibles, things you cannot measure and put numbers on, are more valuable than the tangibles. You can do something that you cannot show how much profits you're going to make. But they're the right things to do. I gave an example. Do we have right to drill and take oil or gas out of the ground? People look at the numbers and say, oh, yeah, we should take natural gas out. It's cheaper. But they don't look at the other value. First, do we have right to do it? Does it really belong to us? And if we take it, how about our children and grandchildren and other generations? How about the pollution side? There are so many aspects that you cannot measure. That doesn't mean that they're not valuable. They're very valuable. So What we do in our company is we emphasize the intangibles, like how beautiful the place is. Is it inspiring for people? And a lot of people in business don't get it, that if people are excited about what they're doing, they're going to get more productivity. If they work on something that they believe in, they're going to produce a lot more. How do you measure it? You don't, but you don't have to. That's where you use your values. So for us, our values are very easily defined, that you've got to use what we call the right road. Keep your values. And if you keep your values, numbers will work themselves out.
I see you writing many things, David.
Oh, this is just a learning opportunity for me.
You know, I guess finally...
I've got a distinctive age difference here, so I'm catching up on my notepad.
You're doing great.
You know, I guess finally, the one thing that I'm really curious about is sort of a personal motivation. And why... I think Eddie, you did talk a little bit about, you know, growing up in Israel and how that has influenced you. But why? What is it about innovation that excites you, and what is it about innovation that keeps your motors running? And where do you see in the second part of that question is where do you kind of see the United States in terms of innovation moving forward, and are we going to maintain our status in this way? What do you see? And if not, what do we need to do? That's a big question. But just sort of sum things up.
Because I've got my opinion. But
basically, personal. What are your personal motivations, and what do you see for the future in terms of innovation?
Okay, I'll Eddie. Speak personally. What motivates me is, I really like to use my life the best way I can to make the world a better world. It's a personal thing that I want to do. I don't want to, just before I die, to say I should have done this, I should have done that. Life is a gift, and you can waste it or you can use it. So I'm trying to do the best I can, use my talent, experience, to make the world better. And in terms of the second part of your questions about countries, United States, I wish there would be no countries, no borders, and no titles. We're all the same, and we have to take care of everybody. If we do, then everybody's going to be better, including us. But all this crazy thing about fighting wars, about people that want to have the same weapons we do, and wars are crazy. This society is not mature enough to just realize that there's more in common between us and the rest of the world than there are differences. So that's what motivates me. And I'm going to do the best I can as long as I'm alive to make the world better.
Great. Thank you. Nina?
Well, I started out as a kid reading science fiction from a very young age, and I loved it because it seemed, most of it, to have a view of possibility and a view of expansion, and it was very, very expansive and exciting. So that turned me into a technologist, and I studied engineering when I started. And at that time, I believed any problem we created, we'd be able to solve with technology. So I was a very big technologist. Learned over time that, ooh, that may not be all it takes because of what happens, the risks, people being resistant to change. So I went and studied change, organization development, and social psychology, and what is that about, and why do people behave the way they do? So when it comes to innovation, it's the perfect marriage. It's the marriage of an engineering background, a business background, a change and development approach, and it was perfect. So the chance to help educate students and influence students in a way that makes them more innovative, more prone to going out in the world and making something happen like David has done, or like Eddie has done, that's just really exciting to me. I also think that we can't stop what we're doing. We need to be smarter about it, but to say, nope, no more innovation, or let's go back to some old ways of doing it without looking at current circumstances and what we can now do, I don't think that leads anywhere good. So I think we have to keep going, but be hopefully smarter about it, more systemic, more systems thinking, if you will, and think about all of the impacts. In terms of where we are as a nation and how we're doing, that's an inherently competitive view. That suggests that we can't win unless others lose. And I don't buy into that. I think that we benefit, our country and our people benefit, as the rest of the world gets better at innovation. There's billions of people whose voices have yet to be heard that are just now getting access through the internet and through other things that will have tremendous ideas that could solve problems that we all deal with. So the idea of the United States has to win somehow in innovation, I don't think of it that way at all.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Well said.
David.
Wow, that's a hard act to follow. I'd say for me, it's all about the challenge. It's about the challenge to change things. I've never understood the word no. My mother always joked that about whether or not I actually had ears on my head when I was hearing the word. But overall, I'd say I'm very optimistic to your question about innovation in the United States. But because of what I've heard so far just around the table, innovators are incredibly optimistic people because they're free to think about what can be and the challenge of making that happen. And that's the path that I think that we're all on. If we can connect with each other, connect with people in other countries, take down the borders, the hatred, the trade disputes, why do we need it? For some reason, we don't need to have those issues between Colorado and Utah. Well, maybe over water, but we don't fight wars over it anymore. Why can't we do that across countries? How do we start breaking down those barriers, have people working together, and have people challenging themselves so much it's somehow people seem to be motivated about challenging others, competing against others. But what about competing against ourselves to become better people, to do things in better ways? Like Eddie was saying, to make the world a better place by being a better person. How do we make that happen? How do we get to that place? And I think the answer to that is we're getting there. We're going there. I think it's a social evolution. We have to learn how to coexist with each other. Otherwise, we will blow each other up. So there's either two options. We'll either work together or we'll destroy ourselves. And I guess that remains to be seen. But I think we'll learn to work together. And I think that's what the human race has shown that it's capable of doing, is adapting to new environments, to new situations, and always solving new problems.
Excellent. Thank you all very much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great experience. That was wonderful.
Excellent. Thank you.